You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. Thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the last 2 hours, and I am Matt Bentman.
I'm Ruth Reyes.
And I'm Alan Alder. On today's programme, we bring you a perfectly balanced diet of fish, meat, vegetables, beer and cheese.
Yes, and on the meat front, roving reporter Rosie Sykes visits the Dingleydale Pork Farm in Suffolk. She finds out all about their superb black pork and the other developments they're working on. I visit new burger restaurant Butch Annie's in Market Street because I really can't talk enough about burgers.
And on the subject of vegetables, well, Butch Annie's does a good range of burgers for vegetarians, but Nazima Pathan will be talking about broccoli as well. And Dave Fox explains how to grow your own potatoes even if you haven't got a garden.
We cover matters beery by visiting Mark Watch of Cambridge's Moonshine Brewery, and Ruth will be nipping into the bathhouse in Bennett Street.
There are a few new cheeses you can buy in Cambridge. We find out more, and also about how you can buy sustainable fish more cheaply than those which are being overfished.
And we keep up to date with the city and university food and drink news, and pay a visit to the university's culinary competition that took place this week.
Mm. If you go to that extremely enjoyable restaurant Blackfoot in London's Exmouth Market, which is co-owned by The Guardian's Allegra Macavidi, you'll notice that most of the pork is supplied by Dingleydale in Suffolk. And there are quite a few highly rated restaurants that use Dingleydale pork, not least Alimentum in Cambridge. But very recently, they started producing a new type of pork, which they've called black pork, and it's got a lot of Cambridge foodies very excited. Rosie Sykes visited co-owner Mark Hayward at the farm to find out how they produce it and what other products they're developing.
We got the opportunity about 4 years ago to work with one of the top meat scientists in the UK. So what we did is basically we were producing an animal that was 25% Duroc in the final carcass. Duroc's a North American breed. As a pure animal, it's not a great producer, but it's great in terms of taste. And if you research Duroc on the internet, you'll find that in Japan they've done a lot of work with it, in America they've done a lot of work with it. So there's a lot of science behind the Duroc as the choice for taste. So what we did anyway, we got involved with these guys. They have a development kitchen up in Yorkshire, and they have a trained taste panel. They've got 25 people who've been chosen for their palates, and they do blind tastings under scientific protocols. So what we did is we brought in two lines, if you like, of two sire lines. One was purebred Duroc, and we bred our sows with that, and the other was a different line. So once you do that, you've then got to wait basically 4 months for the pregnancy, and then you've got to wait 5 months for the animals to be ready to be slaughtered. So it's basically 9 months. When the 9 months was up, we cut, I believe it was 90 pigs, so there was 30 of our normal production, 30 of the Duroc line and 30 of the other line. We took two chops, or I think three chops from the rib end of every loin, and then the whole lot went through the taste testing with all the scientific protocols, which is great, and came back and said that the Duroc line, or what we would term the black pork, more tender, more juicy, more taste. We also sent about 10 samples into some of the top-end food businesses we work with in London. And then we sent 10 samples into sort of your more gastropub-type people. Positive feedback from absolutely everything. We then repeated the whole process again. So it took another 9 months. And then decided that this is what we're going to do. And that's exactly what we've done. And we have been producing a limited amount of what we would term this black pork. But, you know, everything leaving this farm in a couple of weeks' time will be the black pork.
What is it, do you think, is it the marbling that has made the difference to the taste, or...?
It's well documented that the more Duroc you put in the carcass, the better taste you're going to get. We're obviously producing an animal now that's 75% Duroc. We're pretty sure there's nobody in Europe or the States doing that, the level of Duroc we're running at. We've got marbling of about 4-4.5% in it, whereas your normal commercial pork or your standard sort of pork would be running at about 1%. So you've got more intramuscular fat, which is going to give you a better tasting experience, a better eating experience, certainly more tender. It's what you want for cooking. You want that intramuscular fat, that marbling. We're producing quite a decent cover on the pig in terms of back fat, because our business is about, I guess, restaurants, hotels, chefs, kind of, you know, so we're producing specifically for that market, if you like, and via the butchers to the people who like to cook at home.
Yeah, who appreciate.
As opposed to supermarket pork, which would be lean, because, you know, that's what drove the supermarket trade, lean pork.
And in a butcher, they have the opportunity to explain to you what the meat is like and why you should buy it.
Exactly. I mean, what we're hoping, I mean, obviously, you know, I get out of bed every morning and I'm just driven by the desire to produce something more tasty. And that's what gets me going. We get involved in a lot of taste tests in restaurants. We regularly taste tested against Iberican pork or, you know, all different types of pork, which is very interesting. And I'm very interested in the idea that meat should be treated a little bit more like wine. So that, you know, that perhaps we all get to understand the differences in taste, perhaps between different breeds, and just to make that whole meat eating thing much more interesting.
More special, really, as well, which I think it should be, rather than taking meat for granted, to have it as something that's actually, you know, the main event almost.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean.
The only thing I would say to people is, look, you know, to get the best out of it, you've got to cook it pink, you've got to cook it medium, or even medium rare. There are absolutely no issues. But, you know, you keep that to about 60, 62 degrees, it's gonna be beautiful.
So why do people have this thing that you can't eat pork rare?
Well, that all stems back to a problem, a worm in pigs called trichinella. But there hasn't been a case in the UK since, I think it's 1957. So
amazing.
I think you just have this crazy... I mean, you would never cook a piece of beef like you cook a piece of pork.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
So that's what part of what we do is we try and get people to perceive pork in the way that you do beef, to handle it the same, to cook it the same. And, you know, you'll get similar results.
I can't wait to have some. So you also told me that you have been experimenting with dry aging.
Yeah, we're doing some dry aged pork. I mean, it's quite common in Belgium. You can go into restaurants there and you'll see they'll have aging cabinets in the restaurant. And a lot of the retail butchers in Belgium would offer dry aged pork. But yeah, we've been doing some dry aged for about 6 months. Very, very limited quantities, just as a trial, really. And we're now doing that into several different restaurants. But it's very interesting, very much like beef. You lose about 15% of the weight of the meat is lost over the period of dry aging, which could be anything from, say, 15 days to 30 days. You're going to get a stronger flavour, a little bit like you do with beef, and you'll get better caramelisation when you cook it. To give a more tender experience. Very interesting.
You've got some people as well who are making charcuterie with your... But not commercially for sale, I don't think.
No.
More in restaurants or...
The charcuterie thing, I mean, we're now putting in a facility to make salamis, but we're probably, realistically, we're 6 months away from doing that. But we're doing a lot of research at the moment into salamis.
That's very, very exciting. And what about things like using whole legs to do dry cured ham?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we do hams now. You know, it'd be lovely to produce a dry cured ham. I mean, in fact, funnily enough, I've actually got one in my kitchen at the moment from Spain, and it's absolutely fantastic. We're just nailing it every night.
It's just the best thing. It's so easy to eat, isn't it? It was your father who started to have pigs.
I farm in partnership with my brother Paul. We're third generation farmers. So my grandfather actually bought the sort of the main arable farm and where we are now, maybe 100 years ago. So we're a third generation. We've both got three children each, so hopefully there will be fourth generation farmers. Yeah, my father had indoor pigs, and I came back to farm in my early 20s, which was sort of 25 years ago. And so he had indoor pigs, and I started a small outdoor unit, which was very much a sort of one-person farm. And I just enjoyed it much more than I did the indoor ones. So that was when it started, I guess.
And now you're producing how many pigs a week?
We produce just under 300 pigs a week from here, which we would sell twice a week to keep it fresh. And, you know, as you're aware, that, you know, the pretty much the bulk of that goes into sort of hotels and restaurants.
That was Rosie Sykes talking to Mark Hayward of Dingley Dell.
But not solely hotels and restaurants. There are five places you can buy Dingley Dell pork in and around Cambridge. The Art of Meat in Arbury, which is already stocking black pork, the Gog Magog Farm Shop, Cousins in Newnham, the Mill Road Butchers, and the Histon Chop Shop.
So have you tried any of it, Alan?
Yes, I have, and it is really good. The flavour is more intense than it is with, shall we say, normal pork. And it's moister as well, despite the fact that I'm one of those people who overcooks it.
Cambridge 105's proud to be out and about in the city. Do you have an event coming up and like us to be there? Email your details to publicity@cambridge105.fm. Cambridge 105, closer to our community.
Let's stick to the subject of meat for the moment. I could probably eat a burger every day of the week, if my metabolism lets me. And now, Butch Annie's offers basically that. 7 burgers, all different and all made with the best ingredients, and a great selection of craft beers. I dropped by to speak with owners Tim and Nigel. I'm here with Nigel and Tim at Butch Annie's, which opened on Valentine's Day.
Exactly.
How's it been going so far?
Yeah, great, thanks very much. We were very pleased with the uptake. Saturday, we launched with an offer, Valentine's Day, so we coincided the offer with that. We gave away 250 burgers for the first 250 people that came who had tweeted or retweeted our offer.
You guys are an independent burger restaurant. Why burgers?
Well, it's not just burgers, I think. It's food and drink per se. So we like good food and we like good drink. Between us, we have restaurants in London that sell natural wines, craft beers, long-age sherries out of barrels, together with very good real food. The burgers and the beers and the wines that we do here are no different to that. All the products, particularly the meat, are from small-scale farms that are where the animals are reared without chemicals, they're pastured, and they're looked after. And that's really the theme that we try and follow. So we try and stick to that as our ethos throughout, to make sure that we deliver what we say we deliver, and it's a very good product, whether it's a drink or whether it's a food. Aside from that, I have to say, unashamedly, we love burgers and we love beers, and they go together like fish and chips, and there's many people that agree with us the world over, so why not?
Tell us a bit about your menu.
Well, we have 5 best beef burgers, as we call them. Nigel was touching on provenance there. The patties are made from 100% pure breed Hereford cattle. So we've got 5 different combinations for the beef burgers. Then we have something which is completely unique to the high street burger market, if you like, and that is Iberico pork, which comes from the vast Dehesa in Extremadura in Spain. And these animals are more like a wild boar than a pig. They feed mainly on acorns, so they have an incredible diet, and this again reflects in the kind of the nutty taste that you will find in the patty. So again, these animals are, well, they have a very good life, put it that way. So we've got the 7 meat burgers, and then we have, for the vegetarian, from our extensive research, we offer something unique, 7 different burger offerings for the vegetarian. You simply remove the patty, whether it's the Iberico patty or the beef patty, for our special recipe vegetarian patty, and they have 7 vegetarian options. So, you know, Butch Annie's is a great place for the vegetarian. And then, yeah, we've got some accompaniments, the sides, and we have some wonderful artisan ice creams as a freshener-up after the dessert.
Why Cambridge?
Because it's a lovely, lovely place. There seems to be a growing passion in the people here for independent offerings. So we're, you know, being told again and again and again by all the people that we've met over the last few months in our travels up here to research the area and so on. So, yeah, I think there's a tremendous opportunity here, and there's not enough places for people to go, it seems. And again, that's what we've been told, and what we found personally when we've been travelling here. So, yeah, Cambridge is a great place.
Favorite burgers?
Ooh, now you're asking. Well, I've got seven. Personally, I'd probably go for the Ooh La La. That's got a great beef patty, but instead of using lettuce, we use rocket on that with gorgeous garlic mayo and homemade garlic mayo and roasted tomatoes. The whole thing is just a delicious flavour, but to be perfectly honest, and I mean this genuinely, there is very, very little to choose for me between them, because I could eat any one of the seven, be just as happy, because they're all, well, they've been created by us, and they've been created with our taste and passion, so I suppose we would like them all. But yeah, I think if I was going to choose one, that would be the one today anyway.
Again, yeah, it is a reiterate what Nigel said, it's a tough choice, but for today I would say the topsy-turvy. It's called topsy-turvy because the beef patty is not beef patty, it's the Iberico pork patty that I mentioned, and the bacon that you would normally get on top of your beef patty is not pork, it's beef bacon, which again we think is unique. I don't know of another burger bar. We've eaten a lot of burgers over the last sort of year, 18 months, developing Butch Annie's. So yeah, we cure our own beef, been cured and salt for over 6 months. As I say, it's sort of it's topsy turvy, but the flavour is tremendous.
Really, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And good luck with everything.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So I'm excited to make my way through the list of burgers, especially the Iberico pork ones. You can find Butch Annie's where Carrington's used to be on Market Street. Just follow your nose.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop. Your local award-winning food retailer.
And still to come on today's Flavour, some hearty seasonal vegetables, sustainable fish, entertainable cheese, a feature on a famous Cambridge pub, more vegetables, but this time in the form of our Growing Your Own segment with Dave Fox from the Trumpington Allotments, and the food and drink news.
I don't think many would disagree with the statement about beer being a great partner for a burger, which lead us deftly into our next feature. Despite having a heavy cold, Alan couldn't resist the temptation to visit the Moonshine Brewery to find out about the 13 new ales that Mark Watch is producing this year.
This year, Alan, I'm not sure if you're aware, but we've actually got a month with two full moons in. And over the last 10 years, when that year has fallen with the two full moons in it, we've always made a special beer called Once in the Blue Moon. It falls this year. We just thought it'd be a nice opportunity to showcase a few different beers. And rather than just doing Once in the Blue Moon again, we're going to make a beer on every full moon of the calendar month, and a double one in July, with a special beer for that particular month. There'll be a limited range of beers, but limited bottle range of beers and cask as well.
So they're all going to be bottled and cask?
Bottled and cask, yep,
yeah.
Yep.
Right.
Just going out the door as we speak now, Alan, is 13 Moons of 2015, number two, and that is a passion fruit pale ale at 4.2% ABV. Made in the style of our Heavenly Matter, but we've added 15 kilos of fresh passion fruit to our fermenting vessels to infuse it with a bit of flavour.
So the brewery's been smelling pretty good, is it?
Very nice.
And what's coming up later in the year? Have you got any?
Yes, we have. Last year, the farm took part in trials of growing a new variety of malting barley. And we've been recently talking to the company, local company that deals with the seed, about producing some bottles and cask ales using this new malting variety. So that may be our number three, or it might even be number four. It's currently waiting to be converted at a local malting company. As soon as it's done, we'll get the nod on that, and we'll start cracking on making some test beers with a completely new variety of barley that's been grown on our own field.
That's tremendous, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's great. Water from our own well, as you can see over there. We've got windmill electricity as well, so we're pretty we're getting pretty green up here now.
But you don't deliver by bike, though, do you?
Unfortunately, no. It's we've got two of the biggest hills in Cambridge on our doorstep here. Maybe donkey.
And are your outlets growing? Is it
all the time, Alan? Yeah, the outlets are growing. The brewery's going. We're currently undergoing an installation of four new fermenting vessels just to keep up with demand for this summer. So, yeah. And we're still looking for bigger premises as well.
Oh, are you? Because I know that you've expanded your premises here, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, we have, yeah. We're now creaking at the seams here. Yeah.
So it's doing well?
Business is going in the right direction, Alan. It's been a long, hard 10 years. We're still on our 10th year, but it's got a good business plan for the future, and we're looking forward to it. Having employees now working for me as well, two employees. It's taken a lot of pressure off myself, allowed me to concentrate on the marketing side of things, the development side of things, and also the growth of the business as well.
Yeah. Now, tell me about Chocolate Orange Stout, which I think is a fantastic beer, probably my favourite beer. But I don't see it very often.
No, unfortunately, the thing is, because it's 6.7% ABV, it's not the kind of beer you can go to the pub and quaff down. It's more of a speciality beer, and it does tend to end up at beer festivals more than on the pub bars. So just look out for the local beer festivals. Featured at both Ely Beer Festival recently and the Cambridge Canberra Beer Festival, Winter Ale Festival. And it'll be available at the Cambridge Blue Winter Ale Festival in a couple of weeks' time.
Right. And bottles of it?
Bottles are always available from the local outlets, the Bacchanalias, the farm shops, the Shelford Deli, Gog Magog's, Burwash Manor Farms. They will normally have a supply of it there.
There we go, thanks to Mark Watch of the Moonshine Brewery.
Yeah, I think it's great that the Moonshine Brewery are doing so many brews. I think it just shows how confident they are. And the fact that they're expanding, they need to find bigger premises, Mark's taken on two people to work with him, just shows how well it's doing. And I think what I like about it is it's got its success through the quality of what it produces, and that's just right.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
And we are here live in the studio, and you can contact us by email studio@cambridge105.fm, or you can send us a tweet to our Twitter address @flavour105.
Let's balance things up a bit now and turn our attention to vegetables. Back on the market now is sprouting broccoli, mostly in its purple form, but white is available too. Here's Nazima Pathan with some suggestions on how to use it.
What's the best way of cooking broccoli?
There's been some good scientific studies to show that all the good stuff in the broccoli, the vitamins and antioxidants and phytochemicals, do leach out if you boil it. And the longer you boil it, the worse it gets. And so either recipes that involve eating it raw, or if you're going to cook it, then steaming obviously will preserve it and possibly even help release, because it breaks down the cell wall so that the nutrients are more accessible and more easily absorbable by the body. And also, you know, stir-frying or roasting are great ways to get nice flavour and caramelisation. So I would avoid boiling it.
Right, boiling it is what I do, so, so I have to change my habits.
It's not too hard to steam it. You can get one of those little microwave steamers. If you're okay with microwaves, of course, that's another whole kettle of fish.
Okay, so have you got any some specific uses for it?
So the great thing about it is that, the nature of it is that you've got the stalks that are edible and full of flavour, but you've also got the flowery top of it, which can absorb lots of flavours. And so my suggestion would be to cook it simply, either steaming it or roasting it with some olive oil. I particularly like roasting it because it makes it slightly sweeter.
Well, let's just stop on roasting for a minute. For how long and what sort of temperature?
I mean, I just... it's a simple thing. So you could do it like with a Sunday roast, but I would throw them in at the end and probably, you know, at the same temperature that you so between 180 and 200 degrees C until they go brown. So probably about 10 minutes or so. Yeah. And it has a very nice flavour, a bit like cauliflower, which you can also roast and, you know, makes it have a slightly more subtle, more caramelised flavour. It's really nice. And then, of course, the floury tips will absorb any vinaigrette or seasoning you put on. And there's a lot of different ways that you could take broccoli. So, for example, you could use umami-type Eastern flavours, such as soya, miso sort of dressing, or you could use Mediterranean flavours, anchovies in your sauce or capers in a dressing. Citrus, a vinaigrette would also be nice with it.
Wow, this is a revelation.
So it's a great way. I saw a lovely recipe, which was a one-pot dish where you marinate your chicken, some chicken overnight, chicken breasts or chicken legs, with some citrus sauce and some spices in it. Say, for example, you could use paprika and a bit of grapefruit juice or some, and obviously seasoning and herbs. And then the next day, you put that on top of some little new potatoes and broccoli, and you just roast it in the oven. And of course, the whole flavours all mix together really well. So that's another way of doing it. Mm. It's and the great thing is that once you've cooked it, you know, that you can then reuse it in other ways, so that you don't have any waste. So another good idea I came across was using leftover cooked broccoli with some mashed potato and making some potato cakes. You can cover that in panko breadcrumbs and then either shallow fry them or bake or spray them with a bit of olive oil and bake them. Some really nice kind of croquettes in a way.
Yes, lovely. So you get some nice texture there as well, nice crisp potato.
Yes.
There's a lot you can do other than just boiling it.
Definitely. In fact,
I'm going to have to change my habits.
And you could also make a pesto with it. It's another way. You know, again, it's a green thing.
Yes.
You could mix it with some nuts and some herbs and a bit of cheese and Parmesan cheese and make an interesting sauce for pasta. Of course, it goes well with pasta in itself, just chopped and cooked. Don't forget to eat the stalks. If you don't want the stalks in the dish, then use it in soup. But, it, you know, particularly with purple sprouting broccoli, you know, they're tender stalks and easy to...
Yes, I was thinking, because in the sort of... Is it Calabrese broccoli? Sometimes the stalks are a bit woody at the end, so you'd have to cut that away, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
But with the sprouting broccoli, they're always tender, aren't they?
Yeah.
I don't suppose you've come across any desserts using broccoli, have you?
I haven't, actually, no. I did think about it.
Well, if any listeners have any broccoli dessert recipes, do let us know. I must say it seems a bit unlikely, but there was a very enticing dessert using celeriac in the Guardian's Cook supplement a couple of weeks ago, which I shall be trying, if only I could find it. Thanks to Nazima Pathan, Frongley Cook, for that piece.
Too good to be forgotten on Cambridge 105.
Join me, Mark Hickford, Monday to Friday between 9 and 10 a.m. for Too Good to be Forgotten. I'll bring you those tracks from the back of the music cupboard that just don't get enough airplay. Send your suggestions to mark@cambridge105.fm and I'll try and get them on the show. So that's me, Mark Hickford, with Too Good to be Forgotten, Monday to Friday between 9 and 10 a.m. on community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
Perhaps not as a dessert, but broccoli does go nicely with fish. But of course, there are still big concerns about overfishing. The need to eat fish not in danger of disappearing is ever important. The Marine Conservation website gives us guidance, and one fish which may be safe to eat, but it depends on where it's been fished, is whiting. As Danny from the fish wholesalers Marfish explained to Alan at the University Culinary Competition this week.
Danny, I'm interested in sustainable fish, and you suggested whiting as an alternative to...
What, haddock? This is the bit of it. I think a lot of fish like whiting and that are a lot less known. They're a lot cheaper to buy, and the quality, I mean, I've cut a lot of fish in my life, and the quality of some of the whiting is amazing, and to taste is great, so it's a very good alternative, and it's a cheaper product to buy.
Yeah, so how much cheaper is it? Sort of 10%, 20%?
It's probably about 10% cheaper, So it's the same with coley. Coley is a very, like, sort of fish that no one sort of thinks of buying, and it's very cheap, like, very cheap, looking at sort of like £4 to £5 a kilo. Whereas cod is obviously up there with £10-11 sort of kilo.
Right, so coley's half the price.
It's quite a lot different, and I mean, I've got a lot of people that I've given coley to, and they're they love it, do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
They probably prefer it too, kind of, so.
Yeah.
It's the same with hake, for instance. There's not many people think of buying that, and it's, that's a very nice fish. It's very nice, tender meat sort of thing, and that's quite cheap as well, so.
Yeah. But there are some fish, like tusk, for example, which... cheap, but you don't see them very often.
No,
what should
no.
people do? Should they just ask their fishmonger?
Rather than going to a supermarket and going that route, it's always good to have a fishmongers and let them deal with your fish. Like, they're sort of literally a company that deals with solely fish rather than a supermarket that deals with everything. Do you know what I mean?
You were saying before, without mentioning any names, but sometimes supermarkets are selling fish under the wrong name.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, big. Yeah, I mean, I've seen it before, and yeah, they are. That's, and it's they're fooling people basically. So, which is a shame. Yeah,
you think you're buying cod, but actually you're getting something different.
Yeah, exactly right. That. So.
Well, when we talk about meat, we're often told, you know, there needs to be a layer of fat because that's where the flavour is.
Yeah.
Is that the same with fish?
Yeah, I mean, with where the skin is, especially with salmon, you'll find a big layer of skin, like fat underneath it. And I mean, all that is omega-3 at the end of the day. It's all like fatty acids, which are natural and good for you. But obviously, you probably don't want to be overdoing it, eating it constantly every day, do you know what I mean? But you get a lot of customers and they want the fat taken off, so it's everyone to their own. Some people like that fat, some people don't. But
But if you cook the fish with fat, that would permeate into the flesh of the fish, would it, and improve the flavour?
Yeah, I mean, for instance, a good example is salmon. When you're cooking salmon in the oven, you'll notice it almost looks like it's been covered in oil, kind of thing, like it's been cooked in oil, but that's natural oil from the fish itself,
right.
So it sort of makes it nice and crispy, and
And that was Danny from Marfish.
You don't see whiting very often, do you?
No, well, I don't anyway. You do see hake, though, and in fact I had some last night, a hake and a cider sauce from Claudia Roden's Food of Spain.
Where'd you get it from?
There's a fish van that goes to Newnham, and he usually sells it, but not always. Another stall at the Culinary Awards was Cheese Plus. It's a cheese wholesaler. Well, it sells other products too, like charcuterie and preserves, and they do supply some local shops, the Norfolk Street Deli, for example. I spoke with Perry from the company about their cheeses. Perry, you supply cheese and various other good foods to a lot of Cambridge colleges, various shops, restaurants, but including the Norfolk Street Deli,
yes,
I think.
That's correct, yeah.
And you've got some nice cheeses here, some of which I've not seen before. Could you tell us about one or two of them?
Yeah, so namely at the forefront is our very own cheese that we've been creating for the last year, which is the Duke and Duchess. One of them is a wash rind cheese, similar to like an Emmental taste, but it's washed in a Chilford Hall sparkling rosé. It's got some nice almondy, citrusy, fruity notes to it. And then the Duke is a very traditional Stilton with a nice creamy aftertaste, and is proving very popular, as you'd understand, in the Cambridgeshire area.
Red cheese, this looks like a Red Leicester.
So that's a Sparkenhoe vintage, so it's matured more than most of the standard Red Leicester. It's got a nice crumbly texture, but also those crumbles are quite smooth. That salty crunch will be in there as well, but it's proving very popular around the area as well. And then finally we have White Lake Cheese's Driftwood, which is made in Somerset by Peter Humphreys. It's modelled similar to a French cheese called St. Maur, but it's made down in Somerset, British milk from goats. And it's a nice kind of creamy goat cheese, not too goaty up front. Those bounding goats aren't there, that visual imagery. And then you get a nice creaminess and then a citrus end to it.
It's quite a young cheese, this one, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it's very fresh. I mean, you know, the shelf life is around about a month on it.
Does he produce a more aged version of it?
Yeah, another one which is called the Rachel, actually, which is a hard goat cheese. It has like a very firm, plasticky kind of edge, but that's very fruity and also quite like Emmental almost, but got that zesty kind of kick that goat does.
And so, how old is that one?
I think it's around about 6 months, that one, you know, in regards to sort of aging process and wastage when it's about to fall off that cliff in the kind of terms best before dates, it would last a lot longer, other than this fresh cheese, which is almost like the curds of the goat, just going into a mold quite quickly.
Yeah, oh, good. And you've got some nice chutneys here.
Yeah, so Jacqueline from Purely Clear Preservatives, who makes these for us. She locally forages berries, fruits from the area, and she does a sage and red onion. Her favourite is celery, apple and walnut, and spiced crab apple. And it's very popular in the colleges. We can do standard like quince, but these seem more interesting because they're locally foraged. It adds that element of interest.
So you've got the job of going around the country looking for nice food.
Yeah, I have. Very unfortunately. It's very tough. It's very hard. But yeah, I eat a lot of cheese and put on a lot of weight recently. And another good mention is the local honeycomb from Saffron Walden, which is not a usual pairing with cheese, but it's absolutely delicious. I tried to get Spanish honeycomb, some from France, and most of it tasted really, really sweet and very, I know it sounds obvious, but very honey. Taste that was really at the forefront. The local honeycomb from Saffron Walden by John Rayner. He's got 17 beehives, and they're just all very. It's quite clear honey if you look at it. You know that adds to the taste profile, and it's very subtle, which complements cheese really, really well.
Right. Good. Well, thanks very much.
No worries. You're perfectly welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I can never resist a good cheese. So where did you buy these products from, Alan?
Well, you can buy them, in addition to the Norfolk Street Deli, the Cambridge Cheese Company in All Saints Passage, and there's a cheese stall on the market, and Cheese Plus supplies those outlets.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
When we go into shops, restaurants or pubs, they usually seem calm, even urbane places. What you don't see are the often great efforts of the owners, managers and staff they're making to ensure they are successful. Take the Bathhouse Pub in Bennett Street, for example. It's in the heart of the university area with a ready-made clientele on its doorstep. So you'd think they could take it easy. Well, that's certainly not the case, even in the matter of what beers to sell.
For us, normally with Green King, they do the sort of the list of beers that we order every week. It changes from week in, week out. Beforehand, it used to be tied to a lot of the Green King beers that they produce, things like Aberdale, Old Trip. More and more now, on our buying list from Green King, there's a bigger selection. So, I mean, at the minute, we've got a few beers from Belhaven up in Scotland, but a few downstairs from breweries in Cornwall, things like that. Green King do offer for certain pubs a SIBA list, which enables the company or the pubs themselves to select the beers free will. You'll struggle in Cambridge to find that. I think the Granta have that because they're quite big on the real ale. Whereas for us, we're still trying to push to get the SIBA list to free up the beers that we're picking. I think John, the manager, has pushed. He's in the latest issue of the Camera magazine. He's worked pretty hard to get into that Camera magazine. We do try now to have a bit more of a variance on it, so it's not just Green King throughout all of the pumps. And we've got the Green King IPA, 3.6%, that's always on. That's our standard beer. You expect to come into a Green King pub and find that.
Yeah.
Whereas now, because there's a bigger selection for us to choose from, so there is a bit more freedom to it, and it's something that each pub needs to push, really. Like, you can't just... You need to work on it and get a reputation, say that people come in and they get good beer on... You need to be sort of passionate about it and make sure that the person that's dealing with the beers is taking time sort of to follow the process to get it right. So a lot of it is time, dedication. Once you get that reputation, that's when you can start expanding it and not just having your Green King beers, etc., all on the bar. And it's something that we're working quite hard towards, is that while the beers we have on at the minute are brilliant beers, would like to have other things as well. And it's just pushing that with the management at head office to say, look, we've got a reputation now with the beer. We want to have a bigger range to choose from. But that's...
Yeah, does this include independent breweries?
I was assistant manager at a pub in York for about 4 years. When we were Green King, we worked very hard to have independent breweries on. We used to work with microbreweries in York. And since I've came down, it's something that I want to push here, but it's just getting that reputation built up before we get the chance. But we took me about 2 years when I was in York to get these local beers on. It was independent brews. Worked with a brewery called Traboom. Brilliant beers. But the guy that ran that started off, he was a doctor with cancer research.
Mm-hmm.
He decided he was going to pack it in, bought himself a farm, was making no money from the farm, So he thought, well, we'll use the fields and I'll brew. And he used to produce some brilliant beers, Yorkshire Sparkle 3.6%, brilliant beer, loads of flavour in it. But I worked very closely with him when I was in York, and he supplied the 6 pubs at the start of our time working together. After a year and a half, that had expanded to 25 pubs.
Wow.
So it's something I'm passionate about, something that I want to bring down here once we get management head office on our side. I mean, we've just swapped our area manager. He's just brand new area manager, so it's sort of starting again with him. But once the CBA list is independent beers, and if you go to the Granta, they have that, so the beers that you'll have on in the Granta will be Green King, but also independent breweries from the area, which is what you want when you go into a pub.
And that was Jonathan from the Bath House in Bennett Street.
Does anyone know why it's called the Bath House?
No, I don't actually.
Well, anyway, do let us know if you do. You can email us studio@cambridge105.fm or text us. We are here live 07919 070490.
A return to vegetables now. Potatoes, in fact. Quite a lot of us will grow our own tomatoes, but unless you have a garden or an allotment growing potatoes, well, growing potatoes isn't usually done, but it doesn't need to be like that. And if you enjoy new potatoes, perhaps you should think of growing your own. Now is the time, because seed potatoes are now available. And here is Dave Fox to tell you how to go about it.
Dave, this is the time when people collect their seed potatoes. But what are seed potatoes? They're not seeds, are they?
No, they're tubers, so it's I suppose they're effectively clones of the parent plant. And I've got some here.
So they're little potatoes.
They're little potatoes, yeah. It's a known variety that's been multiplied up by the seed producers in Scotland, and then sold to gardeners across the rest of the country. The reason why we buy seed potatoes from Scotland is because they can be certified free of certain diseases, aphid-borne diseases, which don't occur further north due to the different climate. And that's why it's important to use a good seed supplier to get your seed potatoes, rather than just something that's shop bought or off the market, or even something you've saved yourself, because old tubers like that of unknown origin are highly likely to be diseased. And what you don't want to do with plant diseases is complete the cycle and cause a disease to recur.
So these seed potatoes you should get from a certified supplier, and they are really small potatoes, aren't they?
Yes, this tuber of Lady Crystal, an early variety, is about 5 centimetres across, and it's a light yellowy brown colour, and it's got one or two depressions on the surface, and in a couple of those I can see tiny white shoots about 1 or 2 millimetres long, and these are the first signs of growth. Right. This potato. This is an early variety, so as the temperature begins to warm up towards the end of winter, this is one of the first varieties of potato that will think, right, it's time to get going now.
But is it time to get going? Isn't it still vulnerable to frost? Would you plant that now?
No. I wouldn't put it in the ground now. I mean, I suppose you could in open ground if you really covered it with lots of mulch material that's really going to hold the keep the temperature up. But there's quite a good chance of the potatoes just rotting in the ground, especially if we have a late spring, a long, cold, damp spell. So let's and we don't need to plant them in the ground yet. What we should do when we receive our potatoes, we should unpack them and put them in a light, airy, frost-free place, and where the chits can grow with some light, so they don't get long and straggly and weak.
Right, so chits are the shoots.
Chits are the shoots that start from the tuber that are going to turn into the stems of the plant.
Okay.
Looking at the seed potato, it's so much larger than a lot of the true vegetable seeds that we use. It must be 1,000 times the mass of a parsnip seed, for example. So, and I think that shows you that this is a really good choice, especially for novice gardeners, because there's so much nutrient and energy stored in that tuber that it's actually hard to stop it growing. It's grown already, sitting in my hand.
Yeah.
And unless you get really bad disease, I think that seed potatoes, early potatoes, are pretty much a guaranteed crop. And so I would say that's a good one to start with. And even if you've not got much space, much garden space, because potatoes are ideal for container growing. So you'd need something like a pretty large pot, or maybe if you're in Cambridge City, you've got access to one of these old recycling boxes left over since the since the waste collection went to, all to wheelie bins. We've now got lots of these rather ideal veg growing containers, which would be large enough for, say, two or three potato tubers, and you pile it up with compost. And as the stem of the potato grows, you can keep adding compost around it, maybe even build up the side of the container somehow, and you can get a quite a good crop like that. And obviously that's something you could put on a patio in limited space.
And from that one small potato, how many would you expect to get?
Ooh, well, how many is quite a good question. If you want lots of small potatoes, then you can have that. If you want a smaller number of large potatoes, there's a little trick you can use, which is to, as the chits develop, rub out all but one or two of them to reduce the number of stems, and then the plant will have to concentrate its resources into a smaller number of stems, and so you'll end up with larger spuds but fewer of them. So, sorry, I didn't really answer your question there. this will multiply up, I don't know, tens of times in terms of weight, yes. And I do recommend growing early potatoes. If you're going to, you know, perhaps just choose one or two varieties, early potatoes are the ones to go for. Firstly, because they mature from, say, mid-June onwards before the late blight really sets in. That's the worst disease of potatoes, so you're quite likely to get a good crop before the diseases start. But also because these are the potatoes that are more expensive in the shops. Main crop potatoes, the growing regime is just the same, but they're cheap as chips in the shops. So
if you've got limited space, it makes more sense to grow the early varieties.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
One little thing to bear in mind about seed potatoes is that most of them have been treated with a fungicide in order to stop them rotting in store. So after handling them, wash your hands. Don't eat them. Plant them, don't eat them.
Some good advice, and thanks to Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments there. It's also around the time to start sowing some vegetable seeds indoors too. More about that on Flavour in 2 weeks' time.
Every afternoon, 105 Drive wraps up your day with a mix of music and conversation. We'll talk to the people who make Cambridge.
Cambridge got ahead of the game in turning ideas into commercial success.
Keep you up to date on the latest sport.
He was only at Cambridge United for 2 months, but he had a huge impact. He scored the opening goal in the FA Trophy final.
And bring you regular features on food, drink, technology, the movies, and what's happening in town.
I am so excited. This is going to be awesome.
In between, there's the latest news, weather, and travel every 20 minutes to see you through the traffic. Join me, Julian Clover, Monday to Friday from 4, 105 Drive, on Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
And it was the University of Cambridge Culinary Competition this week. It took place at Cambridge Regional College, and the competition happens every 2 years. The standard is, as you might expect, very, very high. I had a meal cooked by Fitzwilliam College chefs, and it was exceptionally good. And one of the most attractive categories for the competition is the chocolate petit fours, which look so perfect and delicate, it feels like an act of vandalism to eat them. I asked one of the judges, Alan Watley, from the Society of Pastry Chefs, what they look for in them.
The competitor would take chocolate, which is already made by the manufacturer, they will process it into individual chocolates. And if they've done that correctly, the chocolate will have a lovely snap. So when you bite into it, it cracks and it breaks. We're looking for interesting fillings, something that isn't too sweet or too sour or whatever, perhaps with a little surprise in the middle of it or something like that. We're looking for something perhaps we haven't seen before. And
what, in terms of content or design or...?
Either. And we're looking at the overall skill level that the competitors are showing. So, at first glance, the chocolates look wonderful. When you start to really get picky, that's when you start finding just tiny little faults. And it's these little faults that can make the difference between winning a gold medal or winning no medal at all.
chocolate. And is there a pattern to the tiny faults? Do people tend to go wrong on the...
They tend to be... There are a sort of set faults that you can look for. Incorrectly processed chocolate. You temper chocolate. Tempering chocolate is basically about taking it through a heat process. Quite a low temperature heat. When you're using the chocolate, it's just on the point of setting, so that everything in the chocolate stays combined, and that is what gives you that. You see, that has got a lovely snap to it. If that had been incorrectly tempered, when you break it, it won't snap nicely. It also gives the outer surface of the chocolate a nice shine, which is obviously... We start eating food with our eyes before we get anywhere near it with our mouth.
And that has got a nice shine, hasn't
it? That's got a reasonable shine. It's not perfect, but it's reasonable. Right. As I say, on the face of it, if you look at a lot of these, they look very good until you start really scrutinising them, and then you can start picking up very small faults, which is just, you know, a mark off here, a mark off there, and that sort of thing. It's also things like having the shell of the chocolate not too thick, the base of the chocolate not too thick. The filling has to be just of the right consistency so that it's not too difficult to eat, or, you know, you don't want to bite into it and have it all run down your shirt and all that sort of thing. So there's an awful lot of things to bear in mind, and those are basically, there's, you know, so it's part visual but part technical.
Some of the decoration on these is very small and very delicate, so presumably
you
count that in.
Absolutely.
And they must take
is a skill.
Yeah.
And we're looking to see that the decoration is consistent with the size of the chocolate. Marks are ordered here, marks are ordered there, and then discussing and coming to a decision.
And is there generally an accord between the judges?
We always end up in accord somehow or another. If we don't, it's why we have three judges.
Thanks very much, Alan.
No problem at all.
And it was open to the public too, wasn't it, Alan?
Yes, it was, and it was really worth going in there because there was some fantastic food to see. And if you're interested, you could follow at Cam's Culinary Co. on Twitter, and they've got a lot of the photographs there, and they really, really are good. You know, the petit fours, but also the main courses, the desserts, the cakes. Oh.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, sponsored by the Gog Magog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
Well, there's no Gigi Parry today. She's at a family celebration, but the news keeps on coming all the same. And since I'm the most recent graduate in the studio, I shall read the university news. On Friday, the 27th of February, Cambridge University Wine Society is holding a tasting of wines from Chateau Leoville Barton with Lillian Sartorius. What a name.
Yes, yes.
Very good name.
The family's tradition of wine tasting dates back to the 18th century. It promises to be a real treat of a tasting. The event will take place in the Gardener Room at Emmanuel College, and tickets can be bought online for £11.
And on to the city news. Let's begin with some new products. A new version of the beer made by Moonshine Brewery using coffee from Hot Numbers is now available, and this one uses El Salvador coffee. Cousins Butchers in Grantchester Street, Newnham, is now doing its own honey roast ham. And also Inda's Kitchen, they're launching a range of frozen curries in 2 weeks' time, and they're seeking Cambridgeshire independent food retailers to stock them. Please get in touch with Inda's Kitchen if you're interested.
Well, right now and until 3 p.m, Steak and Honour are at the Gog Magog Hills Farm Shop, and Gorilla Kitchen will be there tomorrow from 12 noon.
The much sought after Jalan Jalan will be popping up on Friday at Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road with a Vietnamese food night. No booking, it's from 6 to 9 p.m. At the same venue, there is a gin tasting on the 11th of March, 7 for 7.30. Tickets are £25.
There's a beer festival at the Cambridge Blue in Gwydir Street from Thursday of this week, and the range of beers is
enormous.
Enormous.
Ever tried Saudi Arabian cuisine? Well, on the 14th of March, there's a pop-up by Annabelle and Jamie at Sticky Beaks. Tickets from Eventbrite, it's called the Arabian Pop-Up.
Now, there's some very interesting events coming up at the Cambridge History Festival. Next Friday, there will be a camera event. A camera, Alan, stands for?
Campaign for Real Ale.
Mm. And it's at the White Horse Inn, which is about brewing in Cambridge.
It's a test.
There's some beers from the Moonshine and Black Bar breweries available, and the cost is £7.50. Now, on Saturday, there is Hobson's Choice, Life in a Cambridge Pub. There's no charge for that one. Both events will be taking place at the Cambridge Museum in Castle Street. But you will need to book in advance, though. Details are on the Cambridge History Festival website.
Cambridge is proving attractive to eateries seeking to expand. On the way, our grain store, currently in Granary Place behind King's Cross, they'll be opening on the 6th of March in Regent Street, and Wasabi will be opening on the corner of Pedicure and Sydney Street in April or May. And in St. Paul's Church and Hills Road, they're looking for a volunteer to cook for Friday Lunch Club every 4 to 5 weeks. You can get details by phoning Cambridge 576 899 for details.
And that's about all we have time for on Flavour today. You can hear a repeat of this programme tomorrow morning, 7 o'clock, and we will be podcasting early next week.
Coming up this afternoon on Cambridge 105, at 1 p.m, Bookmark is speaking to Grantchester Mysteries writer James Runcie. He talks about why Grantchester is the perfect setting for a crime.
From 2 o'clock till 3, it's Best of the Guests, a roundup of those who've paid a visit to the studios here at 105 over the course of the last 7 days.
And then at 3 o'clock, the new music generator features St. Ives singer-songwriter James Page. He's better known as Sivu, and he achieved acclaim for his debut album last year called Something on High. And he will also be performing at the Portland Arms next week.
From 4 until 6 p.m, it's 105 Sport with Jack Swindlehurst, Ibrahim Rayham and Jack Langley. And then from 6 until 7 p.m, Jason Allen turns with an hour of choice tracks featuring a heavy sprinkling of 80s and 90s tunes.
Flavour will return in 2 weeks on the 7th of March, and if you want to keep up with food and drink news before then, while it's happening, follow us on Twitter at Flavour105 and we'll keep you informed.
So from all of us, and until next time, good eating and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.